Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. He's been called Mr. Pinto. Denny Gioia was the Ford Motor Company's recall coordinator in the early 1970s when a field report about one of the company's top-selling cars landed on his desk. At issue was whether the Ford Pinto's fuel tank posed a serious fire hazard if struck from behind. The case would result in a series of devastating lawsuits against Ford, a recall of 1.5 million vehicles, and charges of reckless homicide. It would also become a case study in business ethics classes and the poster child for corporate greed. How did it happen, and what did we learn from the Ford Pinto case? Our guest is Denny Gioia, now the Klein Professor of Management and the chair of the Department of Management and Organization in Penn State's Smeal College of Business. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patty.
The Ford Pinto was introduced in 1970. It was known as Lee's car, referring to President Lee Iacocca, and it had the ironic tagline, the carefree little car. Begin by telling us about the Ford Pinto.
Well, the Pinto was Ford's effort to respond to the challenge of small cars coming on the market in the late 60s and early 70s, mainly from Germany, Volkswagen. But soon on the horizon were the Japanese manufacturers. So Ford's response was to build this small car by taking a large car and making it small.
I think it's fair to say that you have spent the better part of four decades trying to make sense of the Ford Pinto case and your role in it.
Yes.
Why didn't you just put the whole case behind you?
Well, first of all, you don't put something like this behind you. This case was the first case in business history where a corporation, not the executives within the corporation, were charged with a crime. And the crime wasn't negligence. It was murder. So it's historically significant, and I was involved in the decision-making about it, and so that tends to stay with you for many years. And in addition to that, now that I'm an academic, there are many, many lessons in the case for modern times.
And I want to explore that in just a minute, but it might be worth noting that in 1980, a jury found Ford not guilty of reckless homicide.
That is correct.
Does that make any difference to you?
Not really. First of all, the accident that led to the jury trial in Indiana was
In
1980 was the actual trial. The accident that triggered that trial was in 1978. Ford got a little bit lucky. It wasn't a low-speed accident, as originally was thought. It was rather high-speed, more than 50-mile-an-hour rear-end accident. But Ford saw the handwriting on the wall. It was important to win that case, which they did, so they hired James Neal, a Watergate lawyer, to defend them. That case demonstrated that the Pinto was sort of not even the worst of a bad lot. And so they won the case by demonstrating. But nonetheless, the facts of the matter are that these cars were on the road with much larger cars, and that disparity made them dangerous.
With that as the context, you were Ford's recall coordinator, overseeing a team of five recall officers in 1973 when a report about the Pinto landed on your desk. Describe the decision environment in the recall office at that time.
Well, the decision environment is pretty common to almost all recalls, especially safety recalls. I think what's important for people to understand is that I was tracking everything. There were many possibilities that suggested the characteristics of a recallable case. So I started a folder, and I kept folders on anything that might become or have the potential to become a recall. And I was getting 20 to 25 field reports from around the country on a daily basis. At any given time, I had over 100 active recalls going. I was tracking over 100 cases that could become recalls, and it was my job to coordinate everything and introduce possibilities for votes within the office about whether to forward this with a recommendation to recall to the executive committee. So in my office, you might say everything was a crisis. Everything was a crisis. So we had to differentiate between little ones and big ones. And at the time, the Pinto, in the context of all the other things going on, was decidedly a little one.
At the time, you thought it was a little case. In hindsight, though, today you say you would have decided very differently.
I go back and forth on this. to be quite honest with you. Yes, given what we know about safety and given what we know about corporate social responsibility these days, I think I would have tried to do something that would have led to a different decision in this case. But in the context of the times, you know, and the problem here, Patty, the reason I'm hesitating a little bit is that my current thinking is conflated with the Ford case itself. So a lot of things that we think about these days in terms of recalls and corporate social responsibility are a direct outcome of the Pinto Fires case. So it's hard to parse the two, to separate them and say, if I had known this, I would have done that. It just doesn't work that way.
Malcolm Gladwell did a piece about this in The New Yorker, and you said, what I got from Malcolm was not sympathy, but understanding. He got it. Why is that important to you, that he got it, that he understood the situation you were in?
Well, I think it's very difficult for the general public to understand the recall coordinator's job. And I don't expect them to, and I don't expect sympathy for actions taken in the past. But how can I put this? You know, when you're dealing with these things, you have to take a lot of factors into consideration. The thing that concerns me that relates to so much of modern day activity in this realm is that because you're tracking so many different issues that might end up being recallable, as a recall coordinator, you're always vulnerable to the accusation that you knew you had information and you didn't act on it. Well, I was always susceptible to that charge because there were over 100 cases that I was trying to decide whether they met the criteria for a recall, that is to say, a pattern of failures and some traceable cause for that failure. So the question always is one of when should you pull the trigger? And if you don't pull the trigger, then somebody says, but you had data and you didn't act. Well, that's always the case.
Will you describe this particular job as the busiest and most information-intense job of your career? I want to talk a little bit about how you came to this career. Yeah. You were 26 years old when you were hired by Ford in the recall office.
Right.
Prior to that, you had earned a degree in engineering and a master's, an MBA,
right.
And had spent a little bit of time at Boeing Aerospace.
Yes, all true.
So what training did you have to be in this very, very powerful position of deciding when you should talk to an executive about a recall that could cost them $30 million?
Well, at the risk of being a little bit arrogant, I was pretty good at what I was doing. I was trained as an engineer. I could think like an engineer. I had a technical orientation, and I had an MBA. And when I was at Ford, I was given a choice of pursuing an engineering track to become a PE, a professional engineer, and to end up in engineering at the highest end at Ford, or I could pursue another track that led me into management, into the upper reaches of the executive realm. I chose the latter. And so I did have the multiple perspectives view that was required to do this job well. There wasn't a lot of on-the-job training. In fact, I landed in the recall office because I was on a graduate rotation program that was intended to groom me for the executive track. So I was only supposed to be there for 3 to 5 months, and I ended up staying there for over a year because I was pretty good at innovating how the process worked, tracking all the information. In general, recommending for recall those things that should be recalled and not missing many. Now, that's ironic because I missed the Pinto, so to speak.
In fact, you said before you went to Ford, you would have argued strongly
yes.
that Ford had an ethical obligation to recall. You say after you left Ford, you now argue, and in fact, you teach in your
yes.
classes that Ford had an ethical obligation
yes.
to recall. But while you were there, you perceived no obligation to recall. Explain.
Well, I mean, I went to Ford because I describe myself as a child of the 60s. I was one of the protest movement participants. I was quite passionate about that. But I was also pretty astute to the extent of noticing I wasn't having much effect. So in the idealism of the times, I decided that I wasn't having much effect trying to change the company from the industry from the outside in. So I made a conscious decision to try to do it from the inside out. So I thought the automotive industry.
Not Ford in particular.
Not Ford in particular, because one of the triggers here was Wilson's famous statement as CEO of GM in the early 60s that what's good for GM is good for the country. Now, think about the arrogance of that statement. And I just thought, that's incredible. I mean, it's basically, we'll build whatever we want to build and they'll buy it. I didn't like the attitude. So I went to try to change it. But when you get there, it's as Ariel Sharon once said, given his history. Sharon had been what in the modern vernacular would be called a terrorist, but he became the premier of Israel. And from that vantage point, when asked how he could be engaged in negotiations with the Palestinians, he said, well, it just looks different from here. And that's what I realized when I got to Ford. It looks very different from the
inside. In what way? Did it look like ethical people trying to do a good job?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, I mean, we're often portrayed as ogres in that office. We were not. These were people trying their best to do the right thing. But there were many factors to account for. Not least was that the company had to survive. And it's important to recognize the context of the times. 1973, if you remember your American or world history.
We were in an oil crisis.
It was the first and worst oil crisis. All of Ford's high-profit cars
were not selling.
The only thing that was selling were the small cars.
And there was lots of competition. Yes. And Lee Iacocca wanted this vehicle to be under 2,000 pounds and sell for less than $2,000.
The limits of 2,000, yes.
Now, I'm curious to know, when you got that first field report in 1973, did you know that before rolling out the Pinto, Ford had, in fact, crash-tested 11 vehicles, and 8 of them suffered potentially catastrophic gas tank ruptures? And of the 3 that didn't burst into flames, that was because there were special modifications made to those particular models.
That's correct. But in answer to your direct question, no, I did not know in 1973 about the 1970 pre-production crash tests. That's an interesting part of the story, because a year later, the internal memo reporting the internal engineering tests that revealed the failure of the Pinto to pass a projected standard, not yet the law, was miserable. They tested these 8
all
cars.
All these subcompact cars. But I'm saying the National Highway Transportation System was looking at this rear crash fire problem for all subcompact cars.
And they had proposed a standard that all cars, but most prominently the subcompacts, of which the Pinto was one, should pass a rear-end collision at 50 kilometers an hour. That's 31 miles an hour. And the engineers deciding to see, will our car pass? The answer was no, 100% no on the 8 cars tested. So engineers being engineers said, well, what do we have to do to get this car to pass this new standard if the standard should come to pass? And so they did various things to 3 cars. All of them were successful. They said, okay, fine.
And I might add, inexpensive. Under $11 per car.
Well, one of them was a fuel bladder inside the tank. That's not inexpensive. But the one that was eventually implemented cost 11 lousy dollars per car.
And they didn't do it.
But see, there's an object lesson there. And it's this. Everybody says, why didn't Ford spend a measly $11 to fix a potentially lethal problem? Well, if you look at it from the other side, you can find another 50 things that you could spend $5 to $10 on, and you know which one's going to be the one that gets you, so to speak. So when you look at the constellation from the engineer's point of view, it's not obvious that that is a significant problem.
You mentioned earlier perspective, and in fact, the engineer has a different perspective than the car owner. Yes. Engineers look at compromises and tolerances.
Correct.
And to the car owner, it's a faulty car or it's not a faulty car.
Yes. Customers, I think, understandably, treat cars as either functional or not functional. They're binary. Engineers look at it as a gradient, invoking those two standards you just mentioned there, specification and tolerance. And the question is it tolerant enough of going a little bit out of specification and still being operational?
If you are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Denny Gioia, the Klein Professor of Management at Penn State and Chair of the Department of Management and Organization in the Smeal College of Business. In the early 1970s, he was the Ford Motor Company's recall coordinator when he started getting field reports of burned-out Ford Pintos. He says that with no pattern of accidents with a traceable cause, the Pinto stayed on the road. What would it have required to get the Ford Pinto off the road when you got that first report?
Well, getting the first report would have had no effect. All that did was prompt me to start a file and keep my eye on things. But the fact of the matter is that over the course of the time I was managing this case, the number of field reports never got above 5. When I had to have 20 or 25 to even start a conversation within my unit as to whether to recommend recall to the higher levels.
Now, I should say you don't make these decisions in isolation. You were a team of 5 field recall officers.
Yes.
Did you have to have a unanimous decision about whether something is recommended for recall or not?
No, we had to have a positive decision. But let's just say we were not inclined to send 3-2 votes to Lee Iacocca's level. That was not a credible case. So we would discuss and discuss like juries do to see if anybody would be willing to change their vote. That's not to say we managed the process, but we also were aware if there was that kind of doubt within the office that it was going to lead to doubt at the higher levels as well.
You actually use this case in your MBA classes,
yes.
And you talk to your students explaining the situation in which this case came to be.
Yes.
And it isn't until later in the class, when you ask them, what would you do if you were in the situation, that you reveal to them that you were that guy,
yes,
in the recall office?
I do the case as what I call a living case. Cases are very great teaching devices because, you know, in most instances, those are real people in there trying their best to make decisions. A living case says, in effect, I'm one of the decision makers. You have to deal with me. You have to ask me good questions to get at the issues to understand why this decision happened as it did.
A lot of the students say, I probably would have done what you did. But a number of hands go up and say, absolutely not. I would not,
right,
have let that car remain on the road. How do you feel when students say that to you? And why do you put yourself through that?
Because I don't think there's a better opportunity to make an impact by revealing your personal history and personal lessons than doing it yourself. So, yeah, it feels pretty bad when you get accused and vilified, and I often am. All these years later, I still get phone calls from people, emails from people taking me to task, accusing me of making excuses for the decision made. That's all fine. When you're in the public domain, as I've chosen to put myself, it's part of the experience.
In a way, is this part of working through it? Not to sound like an armchair analyst, but in addition to it being a teachable case study, is it cathartic in some way?
Oh, Patty, I think it was at some point. You have to realize I've lived with this for a long time. I think I've been asked every question that you could think of to ask about it. I've been called everything you could call me. But I'm okay with it, and I'm okay with people asking me hard questions about it.
You said that to function effectively in the recall office, you had to disconnect yourself from the emotional concerns.
Yes.
And you talk about your decision-making process in,
yes,
the Pinto case as being made through what you called script schemas, automated thought patterns. Explain what that means and why that's important today. What other professions make decisions that way every single day?
They all do. I think this is one of the revelations of understanding how people deal with information. We'd like to believe that we manipulate data to arrive at very informed, well-considered decisions. If we did that, we'd never get through the day, especially when you work in an information overloaded environment like the recall coordinator's job
or an air
was.
Traffic controller.
Even worse. you have to remand to memory patterns of expectation about what's going to occur. And when you see a cue in your information processing environment that suggests that this looks like what I expected, then you just go on to automatic.
So it's a sort of framework by which you can evaluate the situation and the data that's presented in front of you.
Yes. Now, what violates that is something unexpected. So people say, but when you saw a burned out Pinto or when you saw this god-awful field report, didn't that snap you out of it? No. You have to understand, to the recall coordinator, seeing terrible accidents
was
a common occurrence.
In fact, you made weekly visits to what you called the Chamber of Horrors.
Our inside label for the parts return depot where we analyzed failed components. I'm using language I was never allowed to use at Ford, by the way. Yes, we inside the company, we called it the Chamber of Horrors. I went there every week. I saw awful things as well as normal failures, if you will.
Lots of people look at a case like this and they say that good people do bad things at work. What situational factors lead to unethical acts at work?
I think there are many. Most people would like to believe that in general they're personal, but I think that's one of the lessons of the Pinto Fires case. If I could use myself as an example, to me, one of the most profound things that happened here is that I went in with the intent to change a corporation. And within 2 short years, I'm the one that got flipped. How do I explain that? And the answer can only be, and I went in with a strong value system.
And the idea that you're going to change corporate America from the inside out.
The organization changed me. I think for most people to understand the subtlety and power of corporate culture is a revelation. So I assign most of the responsibility for unethical decisions, at least ones that are deemed to be unethical, more to macro-level cultural factors than micro-level dispositional or individual factors, yes.
You said that when you look at this particular case, what Ford did when it introduced the Ford Pinto, knowing that it did have this rear-end collision problem, was perfectly legal.
Oh, absolutely.
And some would even say it was ethical.
If judged by the standards of
the day.
The industry, yep.
And
the time, yes.
The problem, you say, was moral. So it was okay on two of the three things that you might look at.
Yes. I get into trouble with some ethicists by trying to distinguish between what's ethical and what's
moral.
But I think it's useful here to say if your standard is comparative within an industry or an occupational group like recall coordinators, it was ethical in that relative standard. If we invoke something that I would label as moral, is there some higher standard that says we value individual lives and therefore should do everything necessary to get a problematic car off the road, then I could be taken to task for not behaving morally, if you will. I don't accept that explanation, but I see the argument and I appreciate it.
You said if it could happen to me.
Yeah.
And you said you were flipped in 2 years. It could happen to anyone. And you did start to evaluate, why did I make the decisions I made? Mm-hmm. The first thing you looked at was my moral compass. Was I phony when I said,
right.
In fact, you said you went to Ford with a reputation as a bleeding heart liberal. The second thing you thought that might have influenced your decision making was intimidation. A third was wanting to keep a good job and sort of falling into Ford's way of thinking, and the fourth was being young and morally undeveloped.
Yeah. Let me talk about the second one you mentioned there, the intimidation, because many people think that this is one of those cases where when you join an organization, you get pulled aside and people have the conversation with you, saying, in effect, do the right thing for the company. I think what's most important for your listeners to understand is that never happened. It didn't have to. I'm a quick study. I picked up on the signal.
You knew how important this Ford Pinto was.
I knew it. So asking me to try to put all the puzzle pieces together was simply not necessary. Was I morally undeveloped? No. I went in with a strong value system, and I think that's another thing that's important to understand. That's not enough. you have to have something that prompts you to say, I'm going to take whatever action is possible to do something about what's going on here.
That brings us to a possibility for a lesson. How important is it when we have people in these kinds of situations, air traffic controllers, for example, who are doing repetitive things day after day where life and death literally hangs in the balance? Mm-hmm. How do you prevent them from making a bad decision?
It's a very difficult question. If you will accept that most people are, in effect, cruising on automatic, running on their scripts, which is necessary to do the job well, as it's necessary to blunt the emotional responses here, you can't do the recall coordinator's job if you want to get emotional.
If you break down every time you see a smashed car.
Yes. So you have to, what I call, put a stop, now think step in your script. Those little cues that look a little bit unusual, you have to say, I have the time to think about them. I'm willing to pick up the phone, call somebody and say, what do you know about this? Because I only found out about that 1970 engineering memo in 1974 when some whistleblower left it on my desk face down. That's the only time I learned that we knew, Ford knew. So who's Ford? Is it the individuals? Is it the company? All of those are interesting academic questions for sure.
Why is this case still relevant 40 years later?
I think it's fair to say that this case, given its historical significance, has changed manufacturing practice and manufacturing liability practice forever. There's no getting around it. This case is pivotal in business history. Other lessons, I think it's an object lesson in the study of the power of corporate culture. There's a lesson in here about organizational learning. If you will, what's it take, Patty, to get these kinds of lessons to disseminate within a company so they don't repeatedly make the same mistake? I frankly think Ford's pretty good at it. Now, if you look around at the GM case and the Takata case now and the Volkswagen case, for goodness sakes, you go, have we learned anything?
Do you think automobiles that are being manufactured today are a lot safer than they were back in the 1970s?
An order of magnitude. That's an exaggeration. But yes, very much safer. But because of the social media environment and various other factors, people much more aware of what's going wrong with cars. So even though they're much safer than they used to be, we're seeing many more recalls. Why? It's because of the visibility.
22 million cars were sold last year. A third more were recalled last year.
Yes.
Are there so many recalls today that they're essentially seen as almost meaningless by the public? I mean, does the public take a recall notice seriously?
Well, it's gotten to be a drumbeat, hasn't it? We're hearing about recalls, serious recalls, all the time, some for safety, some for emissions, as the Volkswagen case is demonstrating to us. Has the public become jaded, perhaps? I think it might surprise you to know that the return rate when people got a safety recall letter was not much more than 50%. It's probably even worse today. And it's free, but it's inconvenient, you see. Or it's not going to happen to me, which is probably the greater explanation.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
That was Denny Gioia, the Klein Professor of Management and Chair of the Department of Management and Organization in Penn State's Smeal College of Business. In the early 1970s, he was the Ford Motor Company's recall coordinator. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.